Hi, I'm Claire Mitchell QC. Welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. I'm a lawyer who specialises in miscarriage of justice cases, and we're bringing you this podcast because we want to tell you about the women who were accused, prosecuted, convicted, and ultimately executed as witches in Scotland.
I'm Zoe Venditozzi, and I'm a writer who's always had an interest in the witches, and I feel that this dark mark against Scotland needs a reckoning.
The campaign Witches of Scotland wants three things. Firstly, a pardon for all those convicted of witchcraft. Secondly, an apology for all those who were accused as witches. And finally, a national monument in recognition of all those who are affected by this terrible miscarriage of justice.
Over the forthcoming weeks, we'll be talking to a whole host of experts about the history and the modern day connections to the Witches of Scotland. Hello and welcome to the Witches of Scotland podcast. This week we're on to episode 34. I know I say this every week, but it's really quite remarkable that we've recorded this many. It's a lot.
It is, and we've also got about 15 other people at the moment who were trying to get round to getting all the ducks in the row so we can get everyone interviewed at times that suit everyone.
Great. I know that we obviously were doing this primarily for the campaign, but I do think this is such an amazing resource for anybody that's interested in the Witches of Scotland, you know, because we have literally put together an amazing resource of not us being the amazing resource. I mean that we've got together amazing resources in the form of other people that are actually experts to talk to us. So it's an enormous like array of info on everything. So I would, if you know somebody that's into the witches or is just getting into it and wants more information, then please point them in the direction, because that's a really big thing for, particularly for me. I think it's really important that people have got access to knowledge. So I think that's a really important thing. So please do tell people about it, not just for the campaign, but just so that they can find out facts from people that really know what they're talking about.
And that's not that face, hands, act, wash your hands. That's a different type of fact.
No, I mean like true facts, okay. But also face and knees and toes and all that jazz.
Shoulders, knees and toes as well.
But ultimately, I don't really care that much because people won't touch us because it's a podcast, Claire.
That's true. It's a safe form of entertainment during a pandemic.
Please don't touch us. Even if it wasn't a pandemic and we were doing a face-to-face thing, I wouldn't want people to touch me. Just want to be really very, very clear about my boundaries, okay?
For the avoidance of doubt, poor listeners.
Just imagine that I'm like the Ready Brick man. It's right. Like a force field. You have to be a particular age to get that reference, Claire. You may be too young. But that's something I want everybody to be thoughtful of.
Sadly, I get it all too well. Do you not remember he starts off, because he has his breakfast and he starts off with that glow, and like the charge on the phone in your battery, it slowly would go back down again during the day.
That's me, except instead of it being like a dried out and then reconstituted breakfast good, mine's more charged by rage. And then over the day, it goes down a bit, but then it gets back up again. It's not healthy.
It's what propels you from bed in the morning and keeps you going all day.
Yeah.
The rage is spent. And then overnight, you build it up again.
I'm not actually that angry. I give people the impression that I'm absolutely furious all the time. I'm not really. I'm not. No, honestly. I'm nice. I can be nice. Anyway, right. Sorry. Back to business. So. Welcome to this, the 34th episode of The Witches of Scotland. This week, we're going to be travelling outside of Scotland, but more of that in a little bit. But first of all, we're going to talk about some women that were accused so we can, you know, humanise these people again. And we're going to be going to Denmark this week. And we're going to be thinking about the fact that the first witchcraft executions in Denmark were of Karen Grotes and Bodil Lauritsen in 1540. In 1543, there was a large witch trial in Malmö, which was centred around Gide Spandemager, and that was a huge thing that attracted a lot of attention across Denmark. I would just like to say a little caveat here, which is that I'm probably pronouncing these names incorrectly, and I would like to apologise to any people that are Danish or speak Danish for any mangling. That's entirely down to me not knowing how to speak Danish. Despite all the programmes I've watched.
I adopt that apology as well in whatever I'm about to see.
Okay, good. So the first person we're going to look at really is Guy de Spandermager. So in 1543, the king, who was Christian III of Denmark, equipped a war fleet to hunt an imperial Dutch fleet away from the coast of Norway to the Netherlands. Outside Helsingør, the fleet was stuck in a calm and the whole project failed. So it was about 40 ships there. So they all came to a stop. And the failure was blamed on Spandermager, who was said to have gathered a group of witches in a valley outside the city and enchanted the ships. I mean, again, this is quite a strange thing. How did they come up with the idea that it was her fault if they were stuck with these ships off the coast there?
Apparently she was the wife of a merchant.
Right. It was beef.
Yeah, so you're wondering whether or not there's a background there of some sort of beef. There must have been some sort of connection because it was said that she had enchanted the ships of His Majesty so as to prevent it from getting any wind. So this poor woman, going about her business, wife of a merchant, one day is told, "We believe you're a witch because our maritime exploits didn't go so well."
And she was tried by the royal governor, Escabild, and unsurprisingly, while she was tortured, she confessed her guilt, and she pointed out several people, men and women, including vicars, which led to the expansion of the witch trial as her words were taken very seriously, as they were in every case that we've read about, that as soon as the accused named somebody else, it seems like that just seemed to be it. It didn't really matter if there was evidence, obviously. They just went, okay, well, they're part of it then. So she named these people and it broadened the trial. And then she said that the enchantments would never disappear unless she was allowed to remove them personally. So meaning that she'd cast a spell and that the only way to undo the spell was that she had to go to the place and do it herself.
I wondered whether or not that was an idea for kind of keeping her alive. Like if people wanted to undo whatever bad they'd said she had done, they couldn't kill her. You know, it might have been a way of trying to save herself. Remember when we talked about the horror witches? Remember the woman who kept herself alive in order to look after her daughter by giving them piecemeal information? Do you remember?
Yeah.
I wondered whether or not it was a bit like that, by saying, if you kill me now, the enchantments will stay. I just wondered.
Yeah, quite sensible. That would make sense. And so the people that she had accused were arrested and tortured. And there's a really unpleasant quote here that says they were tortured so hard their limbs were separated. But despite that, actually, nobody other than Guido confessed. There was a merchant's wife from Helsingør who was released after she was given an alibi by the citizens of the city, saying that she was somewhere else at the time when she was supposed to have been with the witches performing the enchantment. So the Danish obviously didn't have that American spectral thing to get around the actual, you know, alibis.
Yeah, to get around the fact you couldn't be in two places at once in Salem. We just said, oh, that's more proof of the fact that they're in cahoots with the devil, because not only are they in the place where they've got all the witnesses, but they're also committing these acts of witchcraft.
What a shame. And then in November 1543, the king demanded for the rightful old principal of the witches to be burned. And it says here that she seems to have been interrogated for a while after this until she was executed, which is very sad. What a shame.
Yeah.
It's really grim. So the next person then, Claire, is?
The next person that we're going to remember is a woman called Anna Holdings. She was famously in Denmark one of the main suspects in the Copenhagen witch trials, which are parallel to our North Berwick witch trials.
Just to put that into context, it was 1543 that Guido was, well, over 43 to 45 that Guido's trial was. So this is a good chunk of time later. So it wasn't within the same sort of, you know, high panic. It's like, what, 47 by my mental maths years later, which is quite amazing.
That's right. The first person that we've spoken about, she was about in the time of Mary Queen of Scots when the act was brought into force. And when Anna Holdings was being dealt with by the Danish, the link there is that it was her, Mary Queen of Scots' son, who was involved in this whole issue that brought about the North Berwick witch trials and also the Copenhagen witch trials. And the reason for that was in 1589, Princess Anne of Denmark left Copenhagen to marry King James of Scotland. Now, I'm not going to go into this in much more detail because we hear about that in more detail with our expert. But briefly, what happened was there was a storm, the ship almost sank, And in fact, it got turned back from Scotland and had to stay in Norway. James VI joined her there and their wedding took place there. What has this got to do, you imagine, with anybody in Denmark? And why has this got anything to do with witchcraft? Well, in the summer of 1590, a great witch hunt was instituted in Copenhagen. The Danish Minister of Finance was accused by Admiral Peder Munch of having equipped the royal ship so insufficiently that it had been unable to withstand the weather. He, the Minister of Finance, defended himself, saying that it wasn't anything to do with him not having paid up enough money so that the ship had enough resources, but in fact that the storm had, rather conveniently, been caused by witches. And he attributed these witches as being the witches of Karen the Weaver. And he had said she had sent little demons in empty barrels who had climbed up the keels of the ship and had caused the storm. That sounds
so bonkers.
Come on now. Is it possible that a man has failed to properly pay for a ship? Or is it more likely that small demons were sent in empty barrels to climb up the keels of the ship and cause a storm? So you tell me, which is more likely?
Well, I tell you what I find quite interesting about this. This is going to sound like it's comical, but I'm actually making a serious point here. It's a man who's failed to do something and he diverts attention away from himself by blaming a Karen. Now look at modern politics. Look at the decoys of Karens that are used to divert attention away from lackluster, shall we use that word, instead of the real word that I'd like to use, politicians and other men of power. It's interesting.
Well, it's strange that the name of Karen has persisted through the centuries.
How did she get the empty barrels on the ship? Like, what if she's the weaver? Like, what? I don't understand where that's going from. I mean, like, even if Karen had been, you know, a merchant of, I don't know, grog or something. I don't know if that's what they would call it in Denmark. But something more ship-related. Like, how would she get empty barrels on?
Oh, Zoe, you're such a practical person.
I know. It's just silly.
What I like about it is you're worrying about how they get the empty barrels in the ship, but I'm more thinking, how did they get the demons inside the empty barrels?
Oh, that I'm not so worried about. I mean, like, you know, demons are actually quite biddable probably once you've bewitched them. If you've got that level of power, I'm sure it's fine.
I think we're focusing on different areas here. But the background to all of this was a confession given by a woman of the name of Anna Coldings. In May 1590, Anna Coldings was imprisoned in Copenhagen and she had already been judged guilty of witchcraft in a case completely unrelated to this case. So she was found guilty of witchcraft under completely different circumstances and was just sitting waiting her execution. There was a lot of folklore that had grown up around Anna Coldings and she was considered to be a very dangerous witch. There was reference to her given as, in Wikipedia, quote-unquote, mother of the devil. Apparently she was given celebrity status while she was in custody and people were allowed to visit her to see this woman that was a witch. So the finance minister, who was being blamed for the fiasco that had occurred in relation to the royal fleet and this naval embarrassment, asked the mayor of Copenhagen to question Coldings to see if she had been involved in the bewitching of the fleet. Now, I don't imagine it went like this. I wonder if you can tell us if you were involved in the bewitching of a fleet. And she just said, yeah, you're right. Here's what I did with my little demons in a barrel. Mm. But anyway, she was tortured.
It was during torture that Coldings came up with Karen's name, supposedly.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Right.
It was Colding who described a group of women had gathered together in the house of Karen, that's Karen the Weaver, where they had caused the storm and they had sent small devils up the keel of the ship. So that is where that has come from. Coldings was executed by burning in July 1590. And I understand in Denmark, we'll hear more about this again, that that was the method of killing. It was burning rather than strangulation and burning. She, when making her confession, had said that other people were involved. Her accomplices were arrested. She named, in fact, five other women, among them the wife of the mayor of Helsingør. Sorry, we don't know her name, but another woman's name was Margareth Jacob Scrivers. The women were all arrested and charged. Scrivers' husband tried to defend her and get her out of the charges, and unfortunately for him, he himself was arrested and charged with witchcraft for trying to help her. Karen the Weaver, was also arrested, and she, once again, under torture most likely, confessed to having been one of them who, together with Coldings, attended and caused the storms. In total, 12 women, aside from Coldings, were executed for their involvement in the witch trials. And as we know about and have heard about before, that wasn't an end to the matter, because James VI and I then took it upon himself to investigate whether or not there were any witches on his side of the water, and that's where the North Berwick witch trials came about. So we've got one more person to tell you about their story.
And this time we are skipping forward in time for this one. So that case that you've just been talking about there was in 1590 or thereabouts. And then going forward, now I think that this was maybe the last witch trials we're talking about here. And this was forward in time again, quite a jump in time to 1637. So, I mean, you know, you couldn't even have the excuse of, well, they were all clustered together and it was just like one crazy moment. You know, it's a really big amount of time later. And here we're talking about Maren Splud, right? And I think I'm saying that correctly. And I'm really sorry if I've got it wrong. So the first trial was for Maren Thomasdatter Splud, who originated from Grimstrup, which is a village in Esbjerg. She was the wife of a wealthy and successful tailor in the Tower of Reeb in Jutland. Is it Jutland or Jutland? Jutland. Jutland.
Jutland, I think.
And she ran an inn in one of her husband's houses. Now, it says here that she was an independent woman with a sharp tongue. I don't know anybody like that. Diedrich the tailor was an unsuccessful professional competitor to her husband, and he accused her of sorcery in 1637. Now, I think that's quite interesting. I just want to pause there for a second again, because we've talked about this phenomenon of women being executed for being independent, having sharp tongues, but then looking at maybe the broader reasons, I don't want to say real reason, but maybe the more sort of accurate driver is often about money or about power. And so here, you know, the fact that it's a competitor of the husband that's making the accusation, I think that really speaks volumes.
Yeah.
So he accused her of sorcery in 1637, and he claimed that one night he'd been awoken by three witches. Two were unknown to him, but the third was Maren. They'd held him down and Maren blew into his mouth. The day after that, he was sick and vomited up an object that he thought was moving. The object was brought forward and observed by priests and the bishop, who declared it to be unnatural. But her husband stood by her side and managed to have her acquitted of the charges. So that was her first trial. But then there was a second trial when Diedrich gathered witnesses to support his cause, and he went straight to the king, who now is Christian IV of Denmark, in 1639. The king declared that the case should be opened again. So this is 2 years later, right? So the king declared that the case should be opened again and that Maren should bring 15 character witnesses to swear her free from the charges.
I thought that was really interesting, because in Scotland, you have 15 of a jury. It's just interesting that you have 15 of a number. But you'll remember when we looked at the Shetland witches, they had the six oaths, which was if six people got together and spoke to someone's good name, then right, that would avoid them being convicted as a witch. Now, that didn't find its way into Scots law. I think that must be related to Norse law. But
right,
interesting, if Shetland, you were accused of being a witch, you could bring six people to speak to your good character. But in Denmark, you needed to bring 15 people. And I just wondered about that number of people, simply because in a Scottish jury, unlike many others across the world, the amount of people is 15. I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah. I wonder what the thinking for that was.
I mean, obviously in Scotland we have majority verdicts, and a jury of 15 makes it easier to have a majority split, obviously. So odd number, but I just thought it was interesting that it would be 15 character witnesses. I wondered if there was any relevance to that. Anyway,
she didn't manage to get 15 people together though, so she was therefore judged guilty of the charges in 1640. But she was freed by the higher court, which is interesting again. The matter was now brought before the highest court, where the king was a judge. Like, this guy's really determined to get her done for this. Yes.
Look at what happens. The king refers the case to a secular court.
Mm-hmm.
So the merchant goes to the king and says, I really want her done. The king says, okay, I'll take up the case and refer it to the secular court. The secular court deals with it, and on appeal, she's acquitted or she's let go, but then it's appealed to the next court, of which the king, who has been the person who's instigated matters, is the head. So it's perhaps unsurprising that given he was the one of the drivers who instigated matters, that her outcome at that point was, you know.
Yeah, well, he then had her brought to Copenhagen and tortured her, despite the fact that the law forbade torture prisoners before they were judged. So the king just broke the rules and just said, well, we're just going to torture anyway. And the torture, again, unsurprisingly, made her admit guilt, and she then accused a number of other people as witches. And the judgment was, because Marens Blood personally and here before the court, as well as in earlier confessions, said that she had used sorcery and thereby misused the holy sacrament of communion, we found her as a sorceress and on her life suffer fire and stake. So in Denmark, it was often the case that witches were burned at the stake. So the day after the verdict, Maren was executed outside of Ribe. So many people had come to see it that the priest could hardly get to her. She was given a half bottle of alcohol to steady herself and a bag of gunpowder on her back to make the death quicker. Oh, that's so sad. Then she was tied to a ladder and the ladder was thrown into the fire. God, it's so inhumane. It's just, oh, I don't understand like how people could think they were doing God's work and then do such a horrific, ungodly method. It's just, ugh.
And think what that was. That was a woman who was no more than someone who was married to a business rival.
Yeah, yeah. Just, you know, crazy. Totally crazy.
And that's how it ended. But I think, is it correct to say that she was the last person to be executed as a witch in Denmark?
Yes, I think so. And I think we might hear more about that now. We are absolutely delighted today to have a guest with us all the way from Copenhagen. So we're going to be talking about the Denmark Witch Association with Scotland, and maybe disabusing a few myths that we held ourselves. So I would like to introduce to the podcast Associate Professor of Early Modern History, Louise Newholm Kellistrop, who is going to be our fantastic guest for today. So welcome, Louise, to our podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for coming to speak to us, Louise. Our association with one another started, didn't it, when I saw a tweet by you about something, perhaps about the North Berwick witch trials. And I said something like, wasn't it Denmark that taught our King James VI about witchcraft? And you said, no, it was the other way around. Is that right?
Yes, I think that might be a bit me provoking it a bit the other way around piece, but I think that is a myth, and I've come across it quite a lot of times now, that our king taught your king to hunt witches. Our king was 11, 12, 13 years old at that time, so I'm not sure he actually taught so many things. But anyhow, there was a lot of people around him and interested in this, so I think that James might have been inspired by people in Denmark, but I think our king was very much inspired by what happened in Scotland with his brother-in-law afterwards. Inspired, at least, I think it was a formative time and period in his life, our king's life. Yes.
You can just imagine a young boy of that age, be it a king, he's still just a young boy, and hearing stories about witchcraft, etc. it would have an effect on you, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell us, first of all, what was the connection between Scotland and Denmark? You've made reference to brothers-in-law. Can you explain the connection?
In Denmark at this time, we're talking about 1589, 1590, the King Christian IV was actually not yet crowned king. He was chosen to be, elected to be a king, but he was underage. He was only born in 77, so he's, 12, 13 years old. So he was schooled to be a king. He was met with the obligations of being a king, but Denmark was ruled by a group of noblemen from the high nobility. But he was included in these events. And the connection between Scotland and Denmark is that the king had two older sisters, Elizabeth and Anne. Anne was the one to marry James VI. And that wedding was arranged, that marriage was arranged during the spring and summer of 1589. And they were married in August by proxy in Copenhagen. There was a Scottish diplomat in Copenhagen marrying them because James was in Scotland. So she was to travel to Scotland to meet with him officially and to sort of consummate the marriage, of course, and she was to be crowned Queen of Scotland. And they were to leave Denmark around the 1st of September 1589. And before the ships sailed out from Copenhagen, they were met with accidents. There was a sailor that was killed by a cannon, and there were all sorts of accidents even before they were out of the Danish waters. And when they came into the North Sea, they were on several occasions met with this hard weather, tempests and storms, sort of throwing them back and not making it possible to reach the shores of Edinburgh.
And can I check, this was Anne coming across to meet James, whom she'd already married, but was James still in Scotland at this time?
Yes, they were married in Denmark, you would say, by proxy. There was a sort of a diplomat there marrying her, so they would have, but of course she would not meet James until they were united in Scotland. You should picture for you that in Copenhagen in September 1589, there were 13 ships leaving Copenhagen. This was a huge thing, the princess of Denmark to marry the Scottish king, traveling with all these ships, the three largest and most powerful ships of the Danish fleet. And in this period of time, Denmark is a sailor's nation, a sailing nation. So it was a power at sea. So this was the pride of the Danish monarch, the fleet. So I think you should imagine how big a deal it is when these ships are not able to reach the shores of Scotland, because it was the admiral, the highest commander of the Danish military at sea, Peder Munch, in charge of these ships. And on several occasions, they tried to reach Scotland, but it didn't work for them. So they had to move back to Norway and they stayed there. And of course, you probably know the story of James becoming impatient and traveling to Norway and meeting her. But he was, there was a Danish nobleman sent as messenger to James VI, telling him that the ships continued to meet these hard weathers, so they were not able to come to Scotland. And they were now in Norway, in Christiania, today that's Oslo. And they were there, and James became impatient, and somehow he could travel the other way to Norway, and he traveled to Norway, and they were united in Norway. And even though the Danish queen mother was disagreeing and wanted him to come to Denmark to be married, they were married in Norway. And the story is that he insisted on them being married right away. So after the wedding in Norway, they went to Denmark, and they stayed in Denmark from maybe early November. I haven't got the dates quite present, but in the autumn. And then they didn't leave Copenhagen until I think about 1st of May, end April 1590. Oh. So they were there for quite some time. And that's where he met with Tycho Brahe, you know, the astronomer. And he met with Niels Hemmingsen, the famous theologian. I think we can talk a bit about him later, because I think that's maybe where he got his ideas, or at least the Scottish myth about him getting the ideas from that conversation. And then afterwards, the witch trial started in Copenhagen.
Okay, so we have it that Anne didn't make it across, that he managed to get across, got to Norway, married her, and then they're back in Denmark, and they spend something like maybe 6 months in Denmark.
At least 4 or 5 months, yes. 6 months, yes.
And it's during this time somehow that we get the myth that our king came to learn or become obsessed with the idea of witchcraft over there. And it might be, you said, as a result of interactions he had with theologians. Would that be right?
You have to at least acknowledge that he met with Niels Hemmingsen. And Niels Hemmingsen was one of Europe's most prominent theologians. And he was respected internationally. He published internationally, and he also published in Danish. And he was sort of the teacher of Denmark, the master teacher of Denmark, he was referred to. And Niels Hemmingsen has written about witchcraft. But Niels Hemmingsen, when you read the writings of Niels Hemmingsen, he's not a witch hunter. He is very much aware that witchcraft is, of course, a crime, a sin. but it also is a very complicated offence. And only the most skilled judges can deal with it. So Niels Hemmingsen is very cautious about witchcraft and very attentive not to sort of spread a panic. Niels Hemmingsen's also very much aware that the kind of witchcraft that's spreading in villages, you know, where fear is sort of spreading like an avalanche, more or less, that was the sort of witchcraft of simple folk. And that is why skilled and educated judges were always the ones to take care of witchcraft, because that could not be trusted with the simple folk. And that's one part of it. The other part of it is that this is a time of the Reformation in Denmark still, where the king and church, of course, is still working to make people understand that they're now Protestants. They're not Catholics anymore. So they're not allowed to do the, you know, make the sign of the cross, and they're not allowed to sort of exercise their evil powers out of their cows or whatever they would do to inspired by Catholic rituals. So there's a lot of energy put into making people aware that this is actually illegal now. It's heresy and it's sinful to continue to practice these Catholic rituals. And the Danish theologians, a way of making people understand this is to adopt the phrase witchcraft. So they actually say, well, you shouldn't practice all those papist rituals because it's witchcraft. So when you do the sign of the cross and when you try to practice these Catholic, formerly known as protection rituals or healing rituals, they call them witchcraft because that's a way of making people understand this is not legal. You should actually succumb to Protestantism instead. So I think that's why a lot of people have misread some of the Danish theologians to thinking that they actually are warning about witchcraft when they're actually warning about Catholic rituals that people practice because they call them witchcraft. And of course, they have some way of thinking about this as witchcraft, but it's not witchcraft in the village type of a form of witchcraft.
So it was effectively a way of discrediting Catholicism to change people's perspectives on it.
Yes, because I think the two most problematic things in real life in the Reformation of people were the saints, because where could you go when you cannot go to the saints anymore? If you were to pray to saints, that was named idolatry. And of course, idolatry is illegal. So praying to saints is idolatry. And when you practice Catholic healing rituals and protection rituals, well, that's witchcraft. But of course, it's not village witchcraft, but it's named in that way. Some people could understand this is actually illegal. And Hemmingsen and also his predecessors were very active in spreading this message to make people understand that they were to stop practicing these Catholic rituals.
And in Denmark, at the same time as we had the Witchcraft Act, which was 1563, when our Witchcraft Act came into force, at the same time in Denmark, was there also legislation that outlawed witchcraft?
Not much. And there were not many trials for witchcraft. We have an old medieval law against witchcraft. Actually, it's from the 13th century. And it refers to witchcraft as doing harm to people or cattle or livestock. And then we have, during the 16th century, a few procedural laws, sort of regulations on procedure, and they are all for the benefit of the accused person. For instance, you cannot use torture before or after a verdict has been pronounced. So you cannot torture a confession out of people and use it as evidence against a person. And also from 1576, you have to bring all trials for witchcraft in which there has been a guilty sentence. You have to bring it to the second level of court. So you have to try a trial at the appellate court as well.
Does that mean that you had a trial and then once you had a decision in the trial, you appealed it to the appeal court? Or does it just mean that the appellate court did all the trials? So the trials were done at a very high level?
No, they are appealed. And that would also mean that because we have that system where if you are harmed by a witch, you bring her to court.
Yeah.
You are the one, or your husband will bring the witch to court, and then they would negotiate on whether this is a kind of an accusatorial system where you would negotiate in court whether who has the best case. And if the witch is found guilty, you would appeal the case. But if she's acquitted at the second level, then you will have to pay the costs of the trial. So you have to be pretty certain that the verdict will actually also be strong enough in the appeal case.
Wow. So there was an automatic appeal if someone was found guilty.
Yes, but you would, as an accuser, you would have to bring it actively to the next level.
Oh, I see.
In order to have the sentence executed or the punishment executed.
So if you had a finding of being a witch in the lower court, you were the prosecutor and you've got your finding, that didn't actually do anything unless and until you went to the appeal court and the appeal court affirmed it. Wow. I mean, that is...
About 50% of them were acquitted at the appeal court.
When the case was upheld, did they then execute the witches?
After the appeal court?
Yeah.
Yes. They were executed by burning.
So did they kill them? Sorry, this is really horrible, but did they kill them by burning, or did they strangle or hang them first and then burn
them? They burned them alive. It was horrible.
In Scotland, it seemed to be that they strangled them or they hanged them first and then burned the bodies. Mm-hmm. But there's the myth in Scotland that many people still believe until they hear otherwise that the witches, generally women, were burned at the stake. But that wasn't the case here. But in Denmark, they did do that.
Yes. Horrible conversation or topic. But sometimes we know that they put gunpowder on their backs. And that was, of course, not to make a New Year's Eve, but to make the pain shorter, because you would, of course, pass away loudly, but quicker. I do always pause on this when I teach in this topic, because I think it's a very important part of the witchcraft trials and the witch prosecutions is to actually understand that for people in the 16th and 17th centuries, this is very brutal. Even though they're used to corporal punishments and cutting people's fingers off and these kinds of things, being burned alive is not your everyday execution. And executions are not your everyday experience. So this is regarded a very, very brutal punishment in contemporary time and by contemporaries. So I think that's very important to sort of highlight how horrible an offence this was regarded to be also. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so even then, that would be out of the norm. Presumably, there would be other types of offences, like murder, where people would just be executed in a different way then.
Yeah, they would be hanged. Thieves would be hanged, fingers cut off. And if you were a nobleman, you would be executed by sword if you were beheaded, because that was more sort of honourable. And we have only one noble woman being executed for witchcraft in Denmark, and she was also beheaded by sword and not burned alive, because it was regarded sort of the most horrible, brutal and dishonourable way of being executed.
Louise, one thing that we've talked about in our research about Scotland was that people very much did believe that the devil was around and a real entity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, was that the case in Denmark as well, that people really did view the devil as being a real, not a person, but a real figure that was there and did visit these people?
Absolutely. I think there are very many similarities to Scotland on that part. We have a number of sermons and sort of manuals for pastors and also all these pamphlets talking about how the devil is awakened and present in the human world, and he's here to tempt people before the final battle with God. So all this apocalyptic thinking about in a minute or two the world will end and we have to make sure to do penitence before this and not to be tempted by the devil, because then we will not be saved in the afterlife.
So it started off, just to get this clear in my mind, it started off in Denmark to dampen down people's interest in Catholicism. But then at the same time, people did have a real fear of the devil and this imminent apocalypse. So they started to kind of gather momentum with those two things coming together. Is that what happened?
Yes, but it's a bit complicated, because what actually takes place in Denmark is that you have all these messages from the reformers about the devil and the human world, and you should not be tempted by him. And they are very intense in the second half of the 16th century. And we have those trials, and we can get back to the trials connected to the bridal journey in the end of the 16th century. What we will usually refer to as the Danish witch hunt is not before 1617 to 1623 or 24. Throughout the 16th century, witch trials are on a low in Denmark. And actually what happens, and that is peculiar, and I'm researching on this right now, is that whereas it explodes in Scotland, and you could imagine that would happen in Denmark too, but there are 13 people executed in Denmark after this bridal journey. And then it's more or less toned down for 2 decades or so, 3 decades almost. Barely any trials. And then it explodes. And then it's connected to the Lutheran celebrations in 1617 instead, and a whole new religious environment that you have, an atmosphere you have.
And was anything else happening in Denmark at that time as well that might have led people to become so involved in accusations of witchcraft?
I think you have to look very much into the religious atmosphere, where we enter a period in Danish history usually referred to as the Lutheran Orthodox period, where theologians are obsessed with eradicating Calvinists and obsessed with proving that they're actually Lutheran. They're not just Protestant anymore, they're Lutheran now. And they are very convinced that people are sinful, as Luther sort of promoted, and that God is no longer the merciful father. He is the sailor's God that will punish collectively with war and epidemics and hunger and these kinds of things. So this kind of, when you sin, then God will punish the entire kingdom. And it's the, you know, the godly state, if we can refer to Julian the Good Earth book, where he discusses the godly state. We have that, those at that atmosphere, that environment of the king. And that's the same king, because he's king for almost 60 years, Christian IV. He's very keen on promoting himself as this godly Lutheran king.
Must have been a very frightening time for Danish people. Very sort of uncertain time if there was this sort of idea that God could smite you. It wasn't sort of a loving God. It was a vengeful and an angry God. People, it must have been a very heightened atmosphere of accusations. I mean, it's perfect conditions, obviously, for there to be accusations of witches. So to keep yourself safe from God coming and punishing you, find somebody that God would definitely want to punish, and then all the eyes are on that person, I suppose.
Yes, and I think it's really complicated to sort of get into people's heads here, because I don't think that they went around, you know, with their heads bent over and in shame and fear. I think people were happy and celebrating and living life as they do. But of course, they were reminded that they were sinful and they had to do penitence. I'm not quite sure what you would call it in English, but in Denmark, it's something that you do. It's not something that you give, but penitence is yes. All the time, they are warning people about hell and the devil and sin, but they also offer the positive path, this sort of saying, well, you should refrain from sin, and then you should do penitence, because that will save you. So they have a way of dealing with this and acting in this.
Just out of interest, what would penitence be?
Not in the Catholic way, not penitence in that way. It's a very emotional and a very almost bodily experience. You can translate it into convert and give yourself to God and give yourself to Christ. And by doing so, you must open your heart, and you must open your mind and take in the word of God. It is kind of a spiritual way of doing penitence. And then at the same time, you must confess, and that you can confess to the pastor before receiving the Eucharist. If you have sinned openly, you shall confess openly in church. So that's kind of a shaming ritual. But you are not saying prayers. You know, I've worked quite a lot on Italy as well. And a way of doing penitence is when you have to say 15 Ave Marias and you have to do rosaries and all these kinds of things. It's not like that.
Can I just go back a second and talk about figures? You said that during the time of James VI, mm-hmm. right after he came, there were only 13 people killed mm-hmm. as witches at that yes. time. Was that directly in relation to James VI's attendance? Was that about that? Is this where the connection is between Denmark and Scotland and the witch trials?
Yes. First of all, 13 people is quite a lot in a Danish context. So I can get back to that for the same offence of witchcraft or incidents of witchcraft. What happens is that in April 1590, there's a woman imprisoned for witchcraft. And she's not imprisoned for performing witchcraft against the royal ships. That's something else. But she is imprisoned in Copenhagen. Then James and Anne are traveling back to Scotland in the end of April. There's another royal wedding in Copenhagen in the end of April, and they travel back to Scotland after that. Elizabeth, the other sister, is married to a German prince. So they travel back. And then after they're going back to Scotland, this woman imprisoned for witchcraft confesses that she was actually part or leading a society of witches that had cast the storms on the royal ships. So this happens after they're back, they left Copenhagen. And then it starts. And throughout the summer, about 10 women are accused of witchcraft. And throughout the autumn, these trials are led in Copenhagen. I think we can count 13 people, maybe more, because the problem is that the sources are so fragmented and we haven't got the protocols from the court. We have fragments from other trials, and then we have three confessions there, and we have a description there, and then there are a lot of accusations of illegal interrogations of the first witch, and I think she was forced to confess that she had cast the storms. She was an easy target because she was already imprisoned and she was to be executed the next day. So she might as well, you know, get her last 5 minutes of fame there.
And do you think it was, I mean, it's fame now, I suppose, that we're talking about are all these centuries on. You say that she was forced to confess. Now, if she was forced to confess, that would strike me that people were making her confess. And the people who were making her confess must have had intention to do so, i.e. they must have thought, we'll get her to confess to this particular type of witchcraft, because otherwise why would she be talking about the ships? Mm-hmm. Why would she be talking about it? Do you think, and I know that we're only surmising here, but do you think it's possible that they went in with the intention of finding someone to blame for the weather so that there would be a scapegoat for that?
Yes, but I also think that, and we cannot say much about this on the Danish side, but I know from colleagues' recent work, she's been digging into the Scottish archives, that there were suspicions of witchcraft quite early on the Scottish side, because they were in correspondence between officials. They were referred to the storms as kind of witchcraft or suspicious storms. But we haven't got any evidence of those sort of discussions on the Danish side. But we have in Denmark a number of cases in Malmö, which is just on the other side of Øresund, in those years. And we do have some recognition of witchcraft against the Danish royal ships from the king's grandfather in the 1540s. So this is not a new thing, casting witchcraft or using witchcraft towards the king's ships. There are also a myth in Danish history that the king's father, Frederick II, that his ships were also victims of witchcraft, the targets of witchcraft. But that is a made up story, but it's referred to, we talked about initially, those myths that still are all around. Yeah. And you can find that reproduced in the most recent research also. But there, I've been digging into it, and the earliest evidence of it is from the 1680s, something like that. So it's not.
So what we had, going back to the connection between Denmark and Scotland, what we had was Anne not being able to get across to Scotland, then James coming across and marrying her in Norway, then coming back to stay in Denmark, and then travelling back to Scotland. And we know that the crossing that they had back was really difficult as well. Once again, it was difficult. When was it that the person who first said, yes, I confess, I'm a witch, and it's my fault, I was trying to raise witchcraft to stop these ships getting back through. When was it that those accusations and her confession took place? Was it while James was still there in relation to the first crossing, or by the time he got back?
It was, they left, let's just say about, I think the wedding was 26th of April, something like that. And they left immediately after. So we can say maybe he left at about 1st of May. She didn't confess until the second half of May. And she was executed at the end of June, together with another woman who might have committed suicide, might have been executed. We don't really know, but she was also imprisoned after this. So the witchcraft trials in Denmark didn't start until after James had left. But I'm pretty certain that there has been a lot of talking. And also the second sister, Elizabeth, the man she was marrying, was a German prince, also quite familiar with witch trials. I'm writing about this in my book that I'm working on now, because I think that's a part of the story that we have completely ignored, the German connection to this, to Braunschweig. Because, of course, in Germany, there have been some attention to Trier. You've probably heard about the Trier trials that are the most brutal in the entire Europe. And these trials, there were news about them, reports about them in Copenhagen after the king's ships and the incidents with the king's ships. So we know that there were a lot of transmission of knowledge in these times. So there were reports circulating about brutal trials in other parts of Europe. So that people did know about these things. And of course, if the devil is roaming the human world in Trier and in Copenhagen, but of course he will be roaming the human world in Edinburgh as well. And not least because your king was so pious, at least in his own way of thinking about himself. So I think that's... easy to sort of understand why this would be, this was reality to people. They know it existed and they know that the devil will try to harm the most pious and Christian people. But what is also interesting is that weather magic was not a thing in Denmark. This is basically more or less the only incident of weather magic we have in Denmark. But Germany, there were very much weather magic that was much more in discourse of witchcraft. In Denmark, it's about harming people and harming their cow.
And the 13 people that were killed, were they all said to have been involved in the weather magic that impeded the king coming back to Scotland? Okay, so they were all in some way, they got people to confess that they were involved. Yeah. And that was about 13. In your later trials, how many people in your actual satanic panic, as we call it, this many years later, how many people were involved in those trials?
The total figure we have in Denmark for the entire period of the witch trials is about 2,000 cases, and half of them were executed. But that's including Norway, because Denmark and Norway together at this point. But usually, and about 60% of these cases were dealt with from 1617 to 1623. So it's a very short period of time that it was very intense. But usually it's not more than maybe two, three, usually women, linked to each other, sometimes a bit more, sometimes maybe 10, 11, but that's quite rare. So we have these maybe a handful of incidents where maybe a bit more, where you have more than 10 people connected.
So there wasn't really that. I mean, in Scotland, we had quite a lot of large-scale panics.
Yes.
Where there were many people accused at the one time, but that was different. Skipping back again to the connection between Denmark and Scotland, we have the, as you say, the chat between the royals, the Danish royal, albeit he was very young, your theologian, our king, who was very godly, considered himself very godly, very pious. There were other influences. You see that the German royals would have been involved because of the relationship of the family. And the very interesting thing that you see there is that, of course, these were the people closest to God because they were royalty. So they were no doubt the best targets for the devil to cause problems to, because presumably the devil would be wanting to cause problems for the most godly people. That would be the theory. So James comes back across the water with his lovely new wife Anne, and then all hell breaks loose in North Berwick. And as part of your studies, do you know about the North Berwick trials?
Only a little bit. I've really concentrated on the Danish part of it. So I've let the Scots and my Norwegian colleague do the Scottish part of it. But I'm interested in how this affected the development in Denmark, because it was a huge scandal and a shock that must have included a lot of people and sort of stored itself in a collective memory and experience of witchcraft.
It's so interesting you speak about the collective memory, because we've spoken about that as well, and how it might have affected people going forward. Mm. Has there been any attempt in Denmark to recognise, memorialise, apologise, anything of that nature for the people that were killed as witches?
In a very, very modest way. I'm sure you're familiar with the Norwegian memorial. It's very, very beautiful and very moving, I think. In Denmark, we have two plates, you know, the kind of plates you put on a house. And one of them says, this is the house of the poor tailor whose wife was burned for witchcraft. So there's it's the most famous trial in Danish history, because what happens, I should probably add that what happens, whereas our king is very young and maybe a bit naive on witchcraft in the 1590s, he becomes very afraid of witches, but he's also, and he interferes in a lot of trials, but this is not until after 1617. So, but in these early years, he's very young. And he's still a teenager. And this is one of the cases where he interferes. And she's actually acquitted at the trial of appeal. He brings the case to the High Court, where she's sentenced and executed afterwards. So she has a sort of a plate on the house where she used to live. And then there's another. It was paid for by the tourist association of the town. And today, there was just last year opened a museum for witchcraft, the first one in Denmark, in that town. It's called Ribe. It's a very beautiful and wonderful place to go. You should go.
We definitely, definitely. What is it? Did you say it's in Ribe?
Yeah, R-I-B-E.
Ah, I think I've actually been there, bizarrely. I've cycled around Denmark a few times, and it's quite a big town.
It's in southwestern Jutland.
Yes, yes. And it's got quite old buildings in it.
It has an old cathedral. It's in the medieval period, it was a very important town. It was probably the most important town in Jutland. And then from the 1600s, it sort of went downwards for the town.
Yeah, but it still retains a lot of its beautiful old architecture. Yes. I remember there's a pharmacy there. Which is, I think it says it was still there in the 17th century or something. It's beautiful.
Yes, that could be it. Yeah.
Ah, right. Okay. So interesting.
And we have another plate, and it's in a town just south of Copenhagen called Køge. It's a bit difficult, I think, to say in English, but in Køge, and that was a local businessman about 100 years ago putting that plate up, and it just said, well, this was where this happened. So it's very neutral. I think the closest thing we will get to it in the near future is the Museum of Witchcraft the Museum of Witch Hunts, I think it's called, in Ribe. It's a very interesting and recommendable museum.
Presumably it does the right thing, which is remember the people that were killed as witches and the miscarriage of justice, rather than glorify the idea of witchcraft.
Of course, it telling the story and trying to understand and explain. And it has a very moving reenactment in digital, in a screen, but it's in three dimensions kind of thing. It's very modern. On the case of Mans Blitz, you know, the one I told you about before with the king interfered. And it's when you know the case and you read the trial records, you walk away crying. I think I was really moved by it, but I think also people that haven't read the records will be moved by it. I've been affiliated to developing the museum, so they have been all of, and it's one of my old students that have been one of the driving forces in it also, and they're really competent when it comes to witchcraft. They're not, you know, telling sort of sobbing stories or...
Because Zoe and I have been talking about the National Memorial. We're saying we want something to memorialise these women. And people have asked us, as we've been going through the process, what we want as a memorial. And we've now spoken to a number of different countries. And I think, I don't know about you, Zoe, but I think I'm coming to the view that a great way to memorialise these women, a national memorial, would be a museum of, not witchcraft, but a museum of witch hunt.
I think so. I think that'd be really wise, because one of the things that we're noticing about ourselves, as well as about a lot of our listeners, is that most of what we're learning from academics and from people that have been researching is completely new to us. You know, that we don't know anything about it. We knew very, very little when we started this, you know, and it's something that in Scotland that we definitely are not up to speed with, and we're not educated about in school. And I think it would be really great. I think anything where people are learning is a most interesting way of marking events.
Mm. I think that's what they have been trying to do, or at least I know that's what they've been trying to do at the Hex Museum in Ribe, trying to enlighten people and to explain to them. And that's also what I try to do when I give public lectures, trying to make people understand that the people persecuted and prosecuted witches did it for a purpose. They didn't do it because they were evil. They did it because they looked at the world through a certain set of glasses in which the devil was roaming the human world. And of course, there were satanic people back then, as there are today. But this is not a part of the explanation for prosecuting witches. So I think that's important. And I think it's the same. The first book I read on witchcraft in Denmark said there were 9 million burned for witchcraft in Europe. 9 million. And that's about 20 years ago, maybe 25 years ago, I read that book. And that was a middle school teaching book. So I think if that's what we teach our kids and children and young people, I think things have changed quite a lot. But in Denmark, but still, this is something that needs a lot of enlightening work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we're so glad that we've had the opportunity to have you enlightening us and enlightening our listeners, because it really is fascinating to hear how Denmark has dealt with its history, and also to hear about the history of it, because we, like many people, no doubt, just hear the stories and then think, right, that's definitely the fact. But now we can go forward from here and hopefully refer people, if they make the same mistakes as we did up till now, say, no, go and look at the podcast, this episode. You'll hear our associate professor tell us what the actual truth of the matter was in Denmark. So I would just like to, on behalf of our listeners, thank you very much for giving us your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us this week for our 34th episode of the Witches of Scotland podcast. As ever, please do share across the socials, across Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. I'm going to keep saying that even though we don't actually have any TikToks. And like I said at the top of the programme, even though the campaign is working away quietly behind the scenes, there's nothing really massively active to do at this stage. There are lots of people that would love to use this as a resource, if only they knew of it. So please do tell people about it if you think that they might have an interest, because it's just a wealth of information. Again, not from us, from the guests.
Absolutely. I think it would be safe to say we're not a wealth of information. We're a paucity of information.
Yes, I like that. That was quite legal. I like that. Paucity of information. Yes, my love. Correct. So join us 2 weeks from now. There'll be our next episode, which is sure to be fascinating.
Yeah, we look forward to speaking to you then.
Okay. Take care, listeners.
Bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the Witches of Scotland, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Sign up for our mailing list at www.witchesofscotland.com to keep updated with the campaign. On that site, you'll be able to find how to link with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.